And a happy Friday to one and all. Lloyd's going to take a little R&R today, so it's just Jamie and me that are going to get you into the weekend that seems... I've been in one of those weeks where it's kind of like I thought yesterday was Friday, and yeah. That's a horrible thing.
I kept saying, what day is it as we're on this college tour?
It's because we've been on the road. Happy to be back here, but our thanks to our hosts at Wayne State, Ferris State, Michigan State, and University of Michigan Ross School of Business. They were excellent hosts, and we learned a lot. And it was another great opportunity to be able to talk more other than just football and what these institutions are doing for our state.
I thought it was invaluable to understand what they're doing there and the future, what they're learning. I thought it was great.
It was super. So thanks to them. We look forward to the next one, and there will be other opportunities for some folks that we didn't get to. We are learning exactly how much the Ford UAW deal with United Auto Workers Union is going to cost. Ford estimating yesterday that it cost the company $1.3 billion. This is as they exceeded a lot of expectations in terms of their earnings. The estimates as to what this is going to cost them in terms of vehicles, it will add an estimated $875 to the cost of the average vehicle. That's how much you as a consumer will pay for it. Now, in terms of what it will do to the average wages out there, and the labor cost advantage that is now enjoyed by Tesla, Honda, and Toyota. Tesla's all-in labor rate is $45 an hour. The transplants, $55 an hour. With this new Ford deal, $70 to $75 is the all-in hourly wage rate. So Ford, under this deal, will give Tesla roughly a $30 an hour cost advantage. That's nearly 40%. Or more.
That's a lot.
Considerable.
Sean Fain has said he's going to go after the workers of the foreign automakers. We'll see if that pans out. I mean, that could help Ford if he's successful and they see what a great deal he got for Ford workers.
Yeah. Meantime, Vanderbilt professor quoted in the New York Times saying they haven't agreed to anything that will kill their competitiveness. And yet when you look at those numbers, those are somewhat eye-popping. Even Ford says they will look for ways to increase their efficiencies, to squeeze other costs out of the vehicle as a means of keeping up with their competitiveness. We'll see how it goes. Meantime, a really interesting debate going on up in Lansing about just how much we can learn about a lawmaker, their sources of income, and whether or not they have any conflicts of interest.
Especially when it comes to their spouses, Guy. As we know, they have to come up with a financial disclosure policy for themselves, and they're running out of time. And their office holders' spouses, that whole argument has prompted a disagreement among Democrats who control the state government. Tuesday, Democrats in the state Senate introduced their plan to screen for conflicts of interest, which would force lawmakers to report minimal information about their spouses. While the Senate bills would require lawmakers to list their spouse's occupation, it would leave out the spouse's source of income and assets a spouse controls on their own. So it's watered down on one side, and some people are saying, well, if you don't ask for the spouse's source of income, people can just move assets around
exactly.
In the spouse's name. So the intent of the voters is not upheld.
And we already saw this in the Rick Johnson marijuana licensing scheme there, that in many cases, the bribes that were paid through his spouse,
right,
under bogus contracts for bookkeeping services and things like that.
Secretary of State Benson is for this. She says that you should have to disclose things. Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer criticized the idea of requiring office holders to file financial disclosures that include detailed information about their spouse's income and assets. Her remarks conflict with some of her previous statements,
right,
when she said, let's just use the federal disclosure form. But she spoke to the Michigan Press Association in downtown Lansing, and she said she would sign the bills probably that emerge, but there's a legitimate concern that the information about spouses, quote, will be held against female candidates for positions in a way that it won't be held against male candidates for positions. How? I really don't see that.
No,
as a female,
don't either.
Myself.
They keep finding some of the newest, lamest excuses to avoid what every other state in the nation does better than we do.
Yeah, and the voters have said what they want, and they're just kind of like the U.S. House. They're kicking it down the can, and it's getting closer and closer to the deadline.
I've got to give Secretary Benson some praise here, though. She said, yes, I support this because it's better than what we've got. But she says, make no mistake, we've often said we want to go from worst to first. These bills on their own would not take us there. That's perhaps an understatement, but it's nevertheless significant.
And her husband registered to lobby in 2022, so she would be affected by this.
She would certainly fall under that. But it's just, we're going to be talking coming up at 6:35 with Nick Pidgeon more about this. He is a nonpartisan government watchdog. He's with the Michigan Campaign Finance Network. They track the money and the influence that follows it. And he will be looking into this. And there are now competing proposals. I got to tell you, there's a guy named David LeGrand from the west side of the state who's really standing up. He's one of the Democrats there saying, this is unacceptable. We need full disclosure. You need to say how much money you get from each one of those sources of income.
Mm-hmm.
And it needs to be much more robust than it is. And he's
both
really,
husband and wife.
Yes. And he is waging that fight. And I can't endorse him any more than that. Also, overnight, late in yesterday's session, the Michigan Senate just barely approved a 100% clean power requirement, basically saying to our utilities, you must generate 50% of your electricity from renewable sources by 2030. Right now it's 15%. The utilities have said they think they can make that mandate. It ratchets up to 60% in 2035. They must be 100% clean energy by 2040. Now, they could still use natural gas, but they would have to offset it with what's called carbon capture. Well, right now, carbon capture is an unproven technology that's extremely expensive. We know, you know, sometimes these things can develop more rapidly. The cost can fall.
Mm-hmm.
So we can hope for that. Meantime, Republicans are saying, look, this will cause electricity prices to skyrocket. It will lead to more blackouts. They are pandering to the environmental left. It amounts to Soviet-era economic planning. And basically saying, you know, buckle your seatbelts, folks, because we're going to be paying for all this. One of the things they got to do, too, is create an entire battery storage and capacity storage infrastructure, because they acknowledge in Michigan, the sun doesn't shine. Yeah, the sun goes down. You're going to have to put that power somewhere so that you can level out the peaks and valleys.
Yeah, we had utility directors and CEOs, if you will, on our air saying we're going to go a step beyond what they're discussing in Lansing. And we questioned them on price, what that would mean for people. And they said it won't, you know, it'll be nominal. So perhaps they don't feel the pressure as much as the Republicans are putting out there.
But what they are saying publicly and what they are saying privately through their lobbying groups is two entirely different things. And that's the problem. It's they almost, because they are a regulated public utility, they almost can't say the quiet part out loud.
Mm-hmm.
This is going to cost one heck of a lot. And you're right. They say they can do it. We will see. I should point out, though, there is basically a window to jump out of here. If a utility says we legitimately can't do this, it could harm reliability, it will cause an undue financial burden on ratepayers, they can get a 2-year extension. And
okay,
so, you know, the question is, how do you prove that? Look at the regulatory burden of proving it and all the paperwork that costs as well. We'll see. We'll see how it shakes out. Meantime, I really quickly want to get into this mushrooming scandal at the University of Michigan very quickly.
We'll do it quickly here, but I showed you a picture, Guy. It was the Ohio State-Michigan game when a Michigan coordinator is holding a laminated picture of signs, and Ohio State confirmed that those are their signs. It seems this outside firm obtained video from school computers, and they're the ones that tripped this investigation with the NCAA. I'm told NCAA investigators were at the University of Michigan yesterday talking to the football program. And a report came out that TCU, of course, Michigan didn't beat them, knew that Michigan stole signs. Coaches called them before the big game last year in the semifinal and said, this is what Michigan does. And so they had fake signals in that game. So this has been known for a long time.
Didn't help them.
No. Now, the other side of things, people are coming out. Jake Butt is a guy I interview all the time, former Michigan Wolverine. He said, this is not a big deal. This is what everyone does.
Aiden said the same thing at practice
yesterday. I don't know if that's a defense. So we'll see. But there, we could talk about this more as the morning goes on. There's a couple there's for me and anyway.
But when they're holding up these huge laminated sign decoders, if you will, on the sidelines, kind of makes it hard for Jim Harbaugh to say he knew nothing.
I think the biggest thing will be the money trail. Who paid for all this? Connor Stallions making $50,000 did not pay $15,000 to buy tickets and go across the country.
Right. We will see where that, but a lot of chips falling there. We've got a great event coming up next. I guess it's a week from today, isn't it? November 3rd. And Jamie's going to be emceeing it in benefit Parkinson's.
Yeah, the Michigan research. Parkinson Foundation Gala is Friday night, and I've gotten involved over the past couple years because I have some friends on the board. It's a wonderful organization that helps 35,000 Michiganders with Parkinson in the state.
55,000.
Yeah, that's 35, but it's still a lot.
That's still an eye-popping number. Mm-hmm. And it can be so debilitating, hard to manage, but with help and assistance, it can be done. We welcome in Jeff Latham, who's chairman of the Michigan Parkinson Foundation. Jeff, good morning.
Good morning, Guy.
Give us kind of an update on where we are with Parkinson's. We know it has affected so many of our friends and neighbors, also some of our high-profile athletes and others. Tell me about where...
And it's in the family for Jeff.
And exactly. And if it's in your family, it's also an ongoing concern. Tell me about where we are.
Well, you know, just like you said, it's an eye-popping number at 35,000. And when you consider the effect that it has on families as far as taking care of them, the number balloons quite a bit here in Michigan. So as far as research on the disease, there are a lot of strides that are being made on a regular basis. I look back even to 20-some years ago, my dad had neural implants put in to slow the progression of the disease and take some of those symptoms down. And they did work very well, but it's such a voracious disease that, there's the biggest thing that we are out here for is taking care of the people that have it in Michigan. That is our focus: community, exercise, education, and respite.
Jeff, I've done stories on this. It is so important with patients with Parkinson's to keep their body moving. And during COVID, nothing was open. You guys had Zoom exercise classes for patients, and I thought that was pretty cool.
You know, it's amazing what COVID did for us. It brought us out into a new area with Zoom, and it exposed us to so many different areas of the state. The Zoom classes are continuing to go on, and it makes such a big difference. I mean, you look at Kirk Gibson, and he seems to be reversing it with the amount of exercise he's doing. Obviously, he's an elite athlete, but he's been such a great proponent of exercise, and what better of a guy to show that to us Michiganders.
And the sad thing is, it really is kind of a move it or lose it scenario and equation, that if you aren't involved and if you don't have, and in some cases need assistance to do this, you will lose the mobility that you have.
Yes. And having that trainer there and having the ability to see someone help you with the exercise and the enthusiasm at which our trainers do it is infectious. So, turns anybody's bad day around very quickly.
And Jeff, we'll get to the event quickly, but the other part of this is the caregivers and the burden that is on caregivers when someone in your family is diagnosed with Parkinson. Michigan Parkinson Foundation offers some relief to caregivers as well. Explain.
Yeah, so it's financial assistance for in-home or out-of-home care, medication assistance, and mobility loan closet as well. We know that there's times where people need to get away when you've got that constant care. There is a development of education as well for the extended care facilities across the state of Michigan as well. We have modules that we train for because it's a completely different disease than anything else, and it's becoming, unfortunately, more and more common.
We know, Jeff, that as a result of some of the auto insurance reforms, things like that, that we have seen a shortage of in-home care. We've seen escalating costs. For critically injured people, does that also trickle down and make life more complicated and services harder to get for the Parkinson's community as well?
Yes, it does. And we've actually had to make some adjustments on the fly to be able to compensate other individuals, not necessarily the expert care, but sometimes other family compensations that are made
right.
To make up for this, for travel and things of that nature.
Well, and for those that are blessed to have family that can mm-hmm. do that.
Right.
And that's not
mm-hmm.
the case for many victims.
All right, let's talk about this big event.
She's
on
ready.
Friday. I'm very excited to MC. It's at the Henry Ford Museum. And if you don't know about it, tell us about it, Jeff. And you could still get involved if you want.
Absolutely, absolutely. So it's on November 3rd at the Henry Ford Museum. We will have docents there to give the tours of the amazing museum we have there. We've got the Mark Randisi Band entertaining. We have Bill Buckley, who is going to be giving a speech. He is really amazing, and he's a 2012. He was diagnosed with Parkinson's, and he's a shining star of the exercises and the things that you can do. He's so inspirational, and we're going to be talking about all of the great things that we do and celebrating all of the great things that we're able to do for the Parkinson's patients with them there. We have discounted tickets for people that have Parkinson's, and to be able to have a night out like this is something that they're not able to do on a regular basis. So we've designed it to be able to have everybody in for the celebration.
And you can find information at parkinsonsmi.org. And Jamie, have you seen Mark Randisi perform?
No.
Okay. It is like watching someone inhabiting. It's like Frank Sinatra has inhabited his body.
Yes.
He has an amazing voice. He can also kind of channel old Blue Eyes every now and then.
That's cool.
Mark's amazing. So.
And Jeff sometimes gets up there and sings. So I'll expect that on
really?
Friday, Jeff.
Every now and then there's a fight for the mic with Mark and I.
We'll see if we can have a drop the mic moment. Jeff Latham, thanks so much. That is next Friday, November 3rd. And again, tickets are available at parkinsonsmi.org. If you're looking for a fun night out, put that on your calendar for next Friday. Thanks so much, Jeff.
Thank you very much.
We got a couple minutes left here. President Biden has a new contender. He is Minnesota Congressman Dean Phillips. He made the announcement yesterday on CBS.
Are you running for president?
I am. I have to. I think President Biden has done a spectacular job for our country, but it's not about the past. This is an election about the future. I will not sit still. I will not be quiet in the face of numbers that are so clearly saying that we're going to be facing an emergency next November.
And the numbers back him up. The new Gallup poll released yesterday shows among Democrats, Biden's popularity has plunged 11 points to 75%. Overall, dropped 4 points to 37%. We'll be back. Michigan State University Board of Trustees is going to be meeting today. Jamie, I don't want to be snarky, but perhaps should they have a little extra security there just to keep the trustees from brawling?
Oh, my. Well, there are allegations of bullying, et cetera. So
bitterness.
And I know the media is definitely on board to going today, so it's going to be a spectacle.
Yeah, and there has been kind of a meltdown between two specific trustees. You may need some guys in striped shirts there. Maybe you just take the referees off them.
Yeah,
bring in the referees. And
maybe, it's funny, but not funny.
It is.
Because these are supposed to be adults, you know?
Yeah. And Governor Whitmer is weighing in on it now and says, we'll see where it goes. But there have been several calls for the resignation of the chairman of the Board of Trustees. The other skirmish that's going on up in Lansing is over this voter-mandated financial disclosure legislation. When folks passed some of the term limits reforms almost a year ago now, there was a mandate in there to beef up the meager financial disclosure mandates that exist here in the state of Michigan. So Jeremy Moss says they've got a package. He calls it a huge step forward to holding our elected officials accountable to the citizens they represent. Well, it's a step. Is it a huge step? Let's find out. As we open the door this morning to Nick Pidgeon, he's executive director of the Michigan Campaign Finance Network, a nonpartisan watchdog organization that tracks political money and the influence that it can buy. Nick, good morning.
Good morning. How you doing?
Good. So there are all these competing proposals, and it's kind of a moving target here. Based on the latest packages that you've seen, in terms of the sunlight that will be shown on where someone gets their income, how far do these bills go?
Certainly. Well, there's three packages that we've seen. We've seen the original that you were mentioning, Senator Moss's and Singh's bill that came out of the Senate. And then yesterday, the House unveiled their own that mirrors that package. And before that, on the day before, House Bills 5248 through 5258, it goes a little further, especially when it comes to what spouses have to disclose, and even extending to some household members.
Nick, we've been talking a lot about the spouse portion of this, but what is in it genuinely, the other stuff?
So, the spouse portion in the original package. Well, so in the original package, all that would need to be disclosed, it seems, is the spouse's occupation, not even a specific disclosure of the employer and whatnot. In the package that I mentioned before, there would be a lot of the disclosures that the public official or the candidate would have to disclose would be extended to the spouse and family members, including their sources of earned and unearned income and securities and whatnot.
You voice concerns, and other lawmakers actually voice concerns, that the original income disclosure provisions were pretty lackluster, that you didn't even have to account for the percentage of your income or the amount of your income that came from specific sources. Where do we stand with that now?
Certainly. Well, I saw my role when I testified at the Senate Oversight Committee, you know, to kind of compare where all 48 other states who have this law, it's
yeah.
Michigan and Idaho that don't, you know, how our law stacks against it. And, you know, most states have at least a categorical or an exact number disclosure of, you know, how much money is made from sources of earned and unearned income. In Senate Bill 613 through 616, it doesn't seem like you would have to disclose a number. Just if you make over $1,000, you have to describe the nature of the business and the name of it. I know.
Well, how far do you have to go? I mean, can you say, well, I'm in sales? You know, do you have to say you're in automotive sales, that you're in a marijuana business, that you? I mean, how detailed does that disclosure have to be?
Sure. Well, you would have to say the actual name of the organization, a brief description of the nature of it, and even the telephone number where it could be reached. In the other package, there is a categorical disclosure. You would have to indicate whether you've made $1 to $50,000 or $50,000 plus from sources of earned and unearned income.
Senator Ed McBroom has said this is a step of progress, considering we're one of two states that don't require anything. Is a baby step better than no step, or should they do more?
Well, I mean, of course, you know, this is something, as you mentioned, it was mandated by the people. Prop 1 passed with, you know, a ratio of 2-1. You know, the Michigan Campaign Finance Network always believes that, you know, any step towards transparency is a good step. What we've been saying since, you know, the beginning of this year is that if the legislature did go on to pass a law that stuck to the minimum baseline of what Prop 1 mandated, it would be a weak law compared to the rest of the country.
The governor has come out on the spousal disclosure part of it and said she fears it will be held against female candidates for positions in a way that it won't be held against male candidates. Based on your research into this and the way it's been handled in other states, is that based on reality, or is this just her skepticism?
Well, you know, I know that, I mean, the argument on, you know, that representatives have and a lot of people have is that, listen, you know, there's a balance that needs to be struck between how much is disclosed so it's not, you know, completely unveiling the lives for people just to poke around versus what voters need to know to see if there's conflicts of interest or not. You know, in a lot of states, sometimes it's really hard to get your hands on these things if you're not from the state. In a lot of states, you need a state ID to actually see these statements. I don't quite have an example of where, you know, if this was used against female candidates more than male candidates or whatnot, but, you know, it's important that voters have the information about our public officials' income and their sources of earned and unearned income so they can make decisions about their conflicts of interest.
Representative Phil Skagg says he's one of the sponsors that the clause delaying the spousal requirement to 2028 gives candidates and incumbents and their families a chance to see if they want to run for reelection, if this is something they want to open up to the public. What do you think of that aspect?
You know, this is certainly a potential. We saw former Representative LeGrand, when you testified at the Senate Oversight Committee, kind of walk us through, you know, what it could look like, a shifting of assets to
right
to not see disclosure. I mean, you know, certainly the possibilities are endless, and there's a lot theoretically that can happen. You know, pushing it back to 2028 it's an interesting choice, and I guess, you know, you could see some maneuvering, and I'm not sure.
You know, I guess interesting. You're being kind. It's charitable that it's an interesting choice. They're putting off the disclosure that voters have demanded.
What time? When do they have to decide? What's our timing here?
Certainly, we'll decide. You know, how far this is going to go. Well, the deadline for passing this legislation is December 31st. That's in Proposal 1. I will say that, you know, in the original language of Proposal 1, there was no requirement for spousal disclosure or household member disclosure. So, I mean, this is a step in a more transparent direction that is not necessarily required if they stick to the minimum baseline.
All right. Nick, thanks for watching over this and fly-specking all these bills. And hopefully this won't be used as a means for disguising or hiding their sources of income. And maybe it is a step. I think you would join us in saying we wish it was a little bit bigger.
Certainly. Well, I'm going to keep track of it. And thanks for having me this morning.
All right. Nick Pidgeon with the Michigan Campaign Finance Network. Can I just say, it's how disingenuous is it that they're saying we can put this off till 2028? How many of them won't even be subject to this because they will be term limited out?
Well, that's
in the next
part of
5 years,
right? That's
right?
Part of it. And when voters decided they wanted this, I don't think they said in 4 years
exactly.
We want this.
That's not what the voter intent was. You know, another rules for thee, not for me effort. Up in Lansing. By the way, the governor was asked if, based on her concerns about the spousal portion of this, if that was a threatened veto. She says, I am not going to make any veto threats right now. I am going to continue talking with the legislature. Well, she's holding out a veto threat that she could change her mind.
I mean, she threw
that's
a carrot out.
A veto threat. Just saying. It's 6:45 on News Talk 760 WJR. When we come back, we'll get updated on the mass shooting up in Maine. Can you imagine being a resident of Lewiston, Maine this morning? Here you are mourning the loss of 18 individuals of your neighbors, some of them kids, and the gunman's still at large.
And you can't have funerals. You can't gather to mourn because you have to stay in your house.
Exactly, because there's a lockdown. That is life in the 24 hours in the aftermath of this mass shooting that did claim 18 people, many others still wounded. And the community wounded. Tanya J. Powers, our Fox News Radio correspondent, WJR contributor, joining us live this morning with the latest on this now multi-state search for 40-year-old Robert Card. Tanya, good morning.
Hey, good morning.
What's the latest on this search? We know that his car was found alongside a river where he had previously stored a boat. Is the operating theory that he made a water getaway?
I mean, we know that they are patrolling, the Coast Guard is patrolling the Kennebec River. There have been helicopters that have been, you know, flying over that area. We also know that law enforcement agents last night executed search warrants at several properties owned by, you know, his family and family members. They're in Bowdoin, about 30 minutes from the crime scenes. They, you know, said that they did not find him on the property. You may have seen the video or heard the audio of, you know, the law enforcement officials yelling, you know, come out with your hands up, as they were, you know, outside some of these properties. Like I said, he was not found there. As you mentioned, Yeah, that's the thing that you guys were just talking about was, you know, what it must be like for these people for now that, you know, working on the third day of this to shelter in place for that long. The Washington Post had an interesting piece on Bates College and where they had spoken to the president, which they were having an event for him Wednesday night when all of this happened. And he was talking about how, you know, getting all the students back in their dorm rooms to shelter in place was, as he put it, a heavy lift. And they're still sheltered in place in their, you know, in their dorm rooms. You know, it's hard to get your head around what they must be going through, not only just kind of being inside, but also knowing that, you know, it's, you know, wondering, okay, is it, it's obviously not safe to come out yet, but that's a whole different fear. And as you mentioned, they can't gather to mourn the people from their community.
Tanya, there was just an intense manhunt in Pennsylvania. Are those authorities mm-hmm. sharing what they learned with Maine authorities?
You know, I don't know. That's a good question. And I do know what you're talking about. I think they, I want to say that I'd seen a piece, and I don't remember exactly where this was because I've been taken in so much information, so I apologize that I don't have the source in front of me. But they were talking about one of the teams that they had that had been called into Maine to work on this. It was kind of like the special forces of whatever government entity mm-hmm. this was. And part of that was mentioned about the fact that they used this team in the Danilo Cavalcante search. And I thought that was quite interesting that they, you know, have this like elite group of an elite group of the elite, so to speak, to go in and, you know, handle some of this and to help out. As far as we know, like, you know, the things that we understand are there's also three people still in critical condition as of last night. And there's an update from the Army, by the way.
Yes.
Because we were doing stories yesterday about how, because as the information was coming out about this guy, once he was identified, was that he was a petroleum supply specialist in the Army Reserve. He had enlisted in December 2002, Sergeant First Class. And one of the other things that had been put in the police bulletin about him was that he was a firearms instructor. Last night, the Army came out and clarified and said he was not trained as a firearms instructor during his military service. So that part, that's an update to that we've now gotten more clarification from the Army about.
So not an instructor, but clearly adept with his background as a reservist.
Yes, yes.
In terms of the red flags there, what have we learned from his family? I know that they did speak and say that he was hearing voices, that they did their level best to convince him that those voices were not real, that he had this, he felt that he was being singled out for abuse. And tell me where they are today.
I'm not sure what I did not hear the interviews with the family, but I do know that there has been a lot, you know, discussed about his treatment, you know, kind of information. I mean, we don't have a lot of good information because of, you know, obviously HIPAA laws, keep that sort of stuff, you know, details of that sort of stuff under wraps. But the investigators apparently have, you know, spoken on an anonymity about him because they can't, you know, like I said, because
right.
of the laws, they can't come right out and say anything. But that, you know, he had obviously during the summer of this year that his military reserve commanders became concerned by statements that he'd made that it was, you know, targeting his own unit. He was sent to a hospital, according to some of the, you know, the background, like reporting on some of this, where he was there for a couple of weeks for inpatient treatment.
Right.
You know, it's not clear if anything else was done at that point. But yeah, this was apparently known by people who knew him that in recent months he had described hearing disturbing voices. A couple of people who spoke that were familiar with the investigation who spoke, I know to a couple of news outlets said that in recent months he had become kind of fixated on these two locations,
right.
apparently mm-hmm. where he's accused of opening fire.
And yeah, and that the family had struggled with him and had tried to confront these paranoid delusions that he had. Tanya, thank you for your reporting, and we'll hope for a resolution and some peace mm-hmm. of mind for those residents of Lewiston yeah. and the surrounding community. Thanks so much.
Absolutely. Sure. Thank you.
Tanya J. Powers, our Fox News contributor. We should point out We're awaiting next week the Guidepost investigation report for Oxford, where four students lost their lives back on November 30th, you know, almost 2 long years ago.
I can't believe it's been that long. But a detailed independent report on that 2021 shooting at Oxford High School is expected October 30th or before then. And something had come out earlier that parents and family members weren't, they didn't feel it went far enough. This one is supposed to be very detailed, talking with many people, the prosecutor, the sheriff, as well as people within the school, and hopefully we know more of what went wrong there.
Yeah, one of the big revelations in that was that threat assessment teams within Oxford only asked about access to firearms involving troubled students half of the time. So lots to be learned there. We'll be back. Yesterday we told you about the Wall Street Journal article showing that 500 Hamas terrorists were trained by the Iranians prior to the October 7th raid in Israel and from Gaza. Well, now there is some retaliation, overnight against Iran, which has been targeting our troops in Syria and Iraq. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin saying that these were self-defensive strikes overnight. So while you were sleeping, we dropped some missiles on Iranian-linked targets in Syria. All of this in retaliation for drone attacks. One of the things, Jamie, it's been really frustrating. It seems that the Biden administration wasn't engaged in full disclosure about how extensive those attacks were on our troops. Now Politico comes out, and originally it was said, well, they were minor injuries.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now Politico comes out and says 19 of our service members in those units in Syria and Iraq sustained traumatic brain injuries.
Oh.
So much more extensive damage to our troops there than previously disclosed. The Pentagon finally confirmed that yesterday. But there seems to be kind of a whitewashing or a downplaying of what's happening.
It does, depending on how you want to describe it, whitewashing or sort of trying to be very careful in words used to avoid conflict further. That's what it seems like to me. But when our own troops are injured, that's something that should be disclosed.
It's in the inability to call out Iran. I mean, for the White House drumbeat has been, well, we have no direct evidence. Well, now the Wall Street Journal and other intelligence sources say you have direct evidence. Why aren't you acknowledging it? But it also elevates this tension between the United States and Iran. And now we have been hitting their targets after they were hitting ours.
Yeah.
This is no longer just a Cold War.
And in the Arab world, we're already tied to everything Israel's doing. There's some anti-American sentiment everywhere you look.
No question. And on college campuses and elsewhere, that and many Jewish Americans are now confronting all of it, deeply disturbing. We are watching in real time this University of Michigan sign-stealing controversy, if you will, begin to mushroom. But I got to tell you, from somebody that's only kind of loosely been watching it, I got to say, sign stealing, it's legal in some cases, not legal in others. The rules are so nebulous. I think it's leaving some casual fans saying, what the heck's the big deal?
So you think it's a little inside baseball?
I'm like, yeah, would they be going after U of M if they weren't kicking tail right now and doing so well? It almost seems like sour grapes.
Well, it also seems like this is another something that's coming up with this Michigan football program. An outside investigative firm approached the NCAA with files and video from computer drives maintained by the university. The report comes from anonymous sources, but it alleges that multiple Michigan coaches and staff members had access to these files. So that's bigger than just a low-level staffer that's
just Connor Stallion on pay. Doing this on his own.
Yeah, and I'm told the NCAA was at Michigan yesterday talking to the football program and probably getting some more information on who knew what. Who paid for all of these tickets? Was it a donor? Was it Michigan itself paying for $15,000 to go to some of these games here or there? I don't think someone with $50,000 pays all that money.
And again, for those that haven't been watching this closely, the question is, did they cross the line or were they just towing the line as they sought different ways to find out what their opposition was doing?
This is what's confusing. Stealing signs within the game that you are playing is not against the rules. If you look across the way and you can tell what they're calling, that's fine. But if you go in person to other games to scout future opponents,
to like find out what those signs are,
Michigan is alleged to have done, and a network that they had where people across the country would go to different games and they bought multiple tickets. There's a picture of them holding up signs that Ohio State has confirmed is theirs.
And now I'm unsure whether it was the Washington Post or another entity has said that they've got access now to Connor Stallion text messages to others talking about this Michigan manifesto, and that this is all part of a much larger plan where it's like a 15-year plan
yeah.
that he talked about. Which
that
also
seems
sounds
to be
a little
off
crazy,
the wall
doesn't it?
There, yeah. some Michigan manifesto from his part, but it shows how intense he was about his role. And I'm just going to point out that TCU apparently was called by multiple teams within the Big Ten to say, hey, Michigan steals signs, you better watch it. And so TCU in that game used dummy signals. Sometimes they froze a play before the snap to try and combat the Michigan sign-stealing situation.
Exactly. So did you know that if I was to drive you to a polling place as a favor to a friend, I'm going to drive you, maybe your car busted mm-hmm. down, that if you try to pay me gas money, you're subject to, I think it's a $500 fine and perhaps 90 days in prison?
No.
For compensating me for giving you a ride?
No, I did not know that. You brought this up yesterday.
Yes, it's fascinating. There's a bill right now, and Governor Gretchen Whitmer is expected to sign it. It was passed by the Michigan Senate on Tuesday. That makes it legal for you to pay for a ride to a polling place with ride-sharing Uber, Lyft. Right now,
which is so what everyone does if you don't have transportation.
Exactly. Now, there was some intense opposition on the part of Republicans who wanted to make sure that the ride that you're getting into doesn't turn into be a propaganda machine.
Mm-hmm.
But how far do you go with that? If they show up and they've got a Biden sticker on their bumper, is that really coercive influence for your ride?
I don't think so. But some of these senators tried amendments that would stop drivers of paid rides from intimidating or influencing riders to vote in a certain way. So I don't see that in your average Uber. But in this scenario, they came up with, say, a Politico gets buses to bus people in. And then there's paraphernalia and pamphlets and stuff.
Right.
The
if
bus,
you're running a shuttle
that's
service,
obvious.
That's clearly crossing the line. But again, what you're basically doing is saying that the safeguards that we have around polling places now, so that there can't be undue influence, the 100-foot rule, things like that, you're not going to put that. Extending those polling place restrictions universally to moving targets now, Uber vehicles, Lyft vehicles, and my vehicle if I give you a ride.
Okay. Well, I won't ask you for a ride.
Well, I wouldn't ask you for gas money. You know, I do it.
Thanks, out of the goodness of your heart.
I do it. I wouldn't guilt you that way. 712 on Newstalk 760 WJR. When we come back, we'll get on the couch with Dr. Steve Craig. We move therapy Thursday to Friday because we were on our campus tour, so we'll check in with our favorite psychologist in just a moment. In the meantime, let's check in with WJR's Business Beat. Here's Jeff Sloan, founder and CEO of Startup Nation, to spotlight the entrepreneurial tech and startup community here on WJR. Good morning, Jeff.
Good morning, Guy. Jay Davis reported in Cranes that a new Detroit-based group of black business professionals has launched a program with a goal of promoting greater financial security and wellness for the city's small business community. The organization is a nonprofit known as the Metro Detroit Black Business Alliance, and through its small business investment program, its goal is to seed $2,500 investment accounts on investing app Stackwell for up to 200 small business owners and their staffs. The program is supported by a $1 million grant from the life insurance company Prudential Financial. In the entity's press release, they announced that only about a third of black families own stock in businesses, compared with about half of white families, according to the Federal Reserve. Small Business Investment Program aims to improve investment confidence and participation of small business owners and entrepreneurs in Metro Detroit as a catalyst for economic growth in the area, the release states. The organization's CEO, Charity Dean, said the program will help to address some major problems that black business owners face, and that the organization is committed to providing black business owners with the tools, resources, and advocacy needed to not only survive, but thrive. And Stackwell Capital CEO, Trevor Rozier Bird, said the company is proud to deepen its investment in the Metro Detroit small business community through this program. He goes on to say black-owned businesses are a growth engine for the economy and the community, yet they continue to face challenges in accessing funding and opportunities to grow. But through this program, we hope to end this cycle and enable more members of the Metro Detroit black business community to achieve greater personal and business financial stability. The deadline to apply for the Small Business Investment Program is November 17th. Applications are available through the MDBBA website. Great program. Happy to have them here in Detroit. I'm Jeff Sloan, founder and CEO of StartupNation.com. And that's today's business beat on the great voice of the Great Lakes, WJR.
I was saying the other day, a few minutes ago, well, it seems like yesterday felt like Friday.
Yes.
Well, it, you know, normally we do Therapy Thursdays on Thursdays. If the clock is mixed up, it's because we got Dr. Steve here on Friday because we were on the road with the WJR College Tour. By the way, Lloyd's not here. He's got the day off. So do you make house calls? Lloyd would probably appreciate the visit after.
Listening, call in.
There you go. Absolutely. Lloyd, if you're there, 1-800-859-0957. You've got an interesting scenario about communication today.
We'll see how you guys do with this one with your marriages. So, Dr. Steve, my wife and I have been in counseling for a few months, but our communication is still terrible. Apparently, I'm always trying to solve everything, which just pisses her off. And then when she talks to me, I never know what she's talking about because it's always something different. And that just leaves me lost and frustrated. I've tried some of the techniques I've learned through work seminars, like parroting back to her what I heard her say or letting her finish before I speak. But all we seem to do is just fight more. I think all we've learned how to do is argue more clearly. most people say the genders are just too different and it will never work out, but that seems pretty depressing to me. I listen to you guys a lot and you seem to have an interesting perspective on lots of things. So I just wonder what tips you have learned and perhaps what Dr. Steve has to say. Can you tell me your best tips on how to communicate with your spouse?
Guy, you have more years in the game.
I've got 35 years of screwing it up. Is that what you're saying? So, you know, it's funny because Gail and I, it's never forced, and there's no clarity problems. You know, we have a joke. It's like we'll get in the car to drive up north. She goes, okay, let's talk about our feelings. And then I'll say, well, yeah, how about them lions? Yeah.
Avoidance is what you're saying?
Well, to some degree, maybe on that stuff. But you've got to be willing to listen. I don't understand someone that says, well, she talks and I don't know what she's talking about. Mm-hmm. Really? That sounds to me like you've got a listening problem, not that she has a communication problem.
Okay.
I don't agree with genders are just too different and it will never work out well. There are many examples of lovely marriages who've lasted forever. My parents have been married for forever, since 1973. So it can work. I've only been married 7 years. But I would say, don't do the discussion of whatever is your conflict right when it happens, when you're furious. I like to step back, get some context, simmer down, then bring it up. That's what I do.
Well, and you know, if they're, Gail avoids conflict.
So do I.
If I'm upset about something, I will be the first one to admit that I get overly agitated, and she just then withdraws. So sometimes it doesn't always get resolved. But I think that's maybe... It hasn't happened in years.
Maybe the key is to be married to Gail.
No question. Yeah. But then again, sometimes it doesn't. Things can fester. But we learned the hard way that you've got to, when there are things and needs not being met, you've got to express them.
Mm-hmm. I see his exact problem here in this email. I heard something years ago and it was life changing. It's about the way men and women communicate. Our first instinct when there's a problem is always to fix it, where a lot of times, you know, women just want to be heard and they want to be listened to. So he says, let's see, I am always trying to solve everything. Well, maybe your wife doesn't want you to solve everything. Maybe she just wants an empathetic ear and to know that her feelings are validated.
Nah.
Well, it was worth
a
shot.
That's Mike Parsons calling in from Venus to address what's happening on Mars.
You know, you guys said this exact same thing last week. Dr. Steve completely validated what I have.
I like your perspective, Mike. I do. I think that's true.
Right. Yeah. So I think of pieces. There's pieces of every good in all of what we're saying here. But people are always coming to. You know, I do tons of marriage counseling, and they're asking for tips just like this. But the problem is, it's about knowing when. I mean, I could give you 10 different tips, but you have to know which thing to use at what time. And so it's, you know, if I gave you a hammer, but you need a screwdriver, you need to be using the screwdriver, not the hammer. So people, you can even give them tips, but they use the wrong one at the wrong time. So the best thing I like to tell people is lead with your motivation or your intent. And what I mean by this is if I come home at the end of the day, sometimes my wife needs, or sometimes I need to just vent. I just need to throw out everything. But sometimes I need advice, and sometimes I need comforting, and sometimes I need slapped around, like, what are you thinking? Sometimes I need to, she need to tell me I'm the best. But how does she know which one? To Mike's point, you know, sometimes they need to be listened to, and sometimes they need advice. How is, if I was doing that with you, Jamie, if I came home, I needed any of those things, how do you know which one I need?
Right, exactly. And I've seen this on the internet, which obviously better than the internet. But there's this meme that says, if your person comes home and they're mad, do you say, do you want me to fix it for you,
right,
or do you want me to comfort you?
Right. So it becomes incumbent upon me, though, if I was really a good communicator, to come home and say, here's what I'm looking for. So kind of where I learned this is years ago, because I think this was fun, that back when our kids were really young, and our lives were very scheduled. My wife always would go grocery shopping on a Monday. She'd have the kids all day. She'd be doing everything, and she'd get grocery shopping done. So it's 8, 9 o'clock at night. I'm done working, and I think I'm being helpful. And I would call her, and I would say, hey, did you go grocery shopping? Okay, what I mean is, okay.
I'm irritated.
Right. But what my motivation is, she's had a long day. If she hasn't gotten it, I'll pick us up some food. That's what I'm thinking. Is, hey, I'll stop and get us some food. But I say,
bad messaging.
Right. But yeah. I say, hey, did you go grocery shopping? And you can guess what I would get back.
Yeah.
Because I wasn't leading with, here's what my intent is. So she's got to fill in the gap, and she's going to fill it in with whatever's going on in her world. So I'm always talking about people, yes, you got to learn to listen well. And sometimes you got to learn to give advice. And sometimes you got to just be comforting. But each person has to be able to tell you what I'm looking for. Here, you know, I need to vent. I need your advice. I need you just to tell me the world's okay. I need you to help distract me and laugh. If I can tell you how to listen, you will do a way better job at it.
That's we also great. Have so many distractions to the communicating process. Example, last night, I'm communicating with Nick. I'm just texting back and forth with him on an issue. While Gail's talking to me about something else, and she finally realizes that she doesn't have my full attention. And so, you know, what do we do about that? The fact that sometimes we don't have our spouse's full attention,
well,
or their mind is elsewhere.
But it gets back into it's based around what I was just saying, which is we just say things rather than give that precursor to here's what I'm looking for, or here's what I need. So if Gail wants your full attention and she doesn't have it, what happens is you're distracted.
I'm whatever. Trying to multitask is
right,
what I'm trying to
right,
do. And
right.
I'm not sure that was appreciated.
But usually if we were to go back and do, you know, an autopsy on that, when it started, there wasn't a clear communication about, you know, hey, guy, I need this. Can I have your attention?
Yeah.
She just probably started talking and you mm-hmm. did whatever you do. But we really rarely talk. We just start talking. I might say, hey, why'd you get your haircut like that? And now you're like, wah!
Yeah.
Instead of me going, I really like your haircut. What did you do? Or Gail should say, hey, I need to ask you something. And I need you for 5 minutes because I need you to do whatever.
Full attention.
But we gotta prep everybody because we're all in our own world. I'm sure Guy was on his phone. Nick was annoying him. Whatever was going on, he's stuck with that. But if you lead all
my
the
other
time,
spouse, Nick Rowdy. Nick Rowdy, yeah.
But, you know, who... If you always learn and train yourself to lead with what I'm looking for.
Yeah.
My wife's a marriage counselor, too. So people always come to our house and they're like, this is the weirdest house, because we both always say, instead of saying, hey, are you going to bring the laundry down this morning? Which, I mean, wow, you know, she says, hey, my schedule today is I'm doing laundry in the morning. Can you bring the laundry down this morning? That's okay. Okay, fine. I'll take care of it.
Yeah.
But we're always leading with why we're communicating what we're communicating.
I like that. I could bring that home. Mm-hmm. Brian, if you're listening.
Good tip. And always remember, it comes from a good place.
That's right.
Try to assume it comes from a good place.
Right, right.
That's helpful as well. Yeah, Nick, you didn't know that you were a problem last night. You didn't
came
even know.
Between his marriage.
Yeah.
Isaac
knows about that. It's like, yeah, responding to Nick's text. Dr. Steve, thanks so much.
All right, we'll see
He's
you guys.
He's Dr. Steve Craig, corporate coach for Craig Counseling Services. The ratification process is underway for the tentative agreement between Ford and the UAW. We anticipate that members of the Ford National Council will be hitting town either later today or tomorrow. The big meeting coming up on Sunday. If they green light it, then they will begin the information process and the real dissemination of the nitty-gritty details of this new agreement, a four-year deal that will significantly raise wages for temporary workers and for the rank and file at large, 25% wage hike. But it also dramatically increases the gap between the Teslas, the transplants, and Ford Motor Company. So is this something that Ford can manage? Or, as they had said throughout negotiations, could it cripple their ability to invest in the future, EVs, and thus? We welcome in Daniel Howes, who's been watching it all as one of the most seasoned observers of the automotive industry, as senior editor and columnist for the Detroit News. Daniel, good morning.
Morning. How are you?
Very good. As you talk to different analysts as they look at the all-in wage and what this will do from a competitive standpoint, is this something that Ford Motor Company can manage?
I think the feeling is that they think they can, but I think there's a number of assumptions about the market and sales of consumer demand and things like electric vehicles and continued demand for the money machines of F-Series pickups and full-size SUVs. But I don't think there's any doubt this is a chunk probably will go down. I think I was thinking about this. It's probably easily the best deal in a generation. Certainly reverses a number of things from the 2007 contract and then the truly concessionary contracts of the bankruptcy and the meltdown. So, I mean, I think this is quite a bit of progress for the union. But I'm reminded of a story an old friend of mine at General Motors told when he talked to one of his counterparts at Bethlehem Steel after they'd gone bankrupt and they'd agreed to a deal. And he said, if you knew you were going to go bankrupt, why did you do it? He said, because we didn't have any choice. And I'm not suggesting that's the case here, but some of the dynamics are similar. I mean, I've never seen a UAW as squeezed as effectively as this UAW under Sean Fain, and really, I think, bring these companies to a point that they really didn't have a lot of wiggle room.
Daniel, you say it's the best deal in a generation, but he did not get that 32-hour work week, a return to traditional pensions. Is this a done deal, or could some of the rank and file say, I don't like this?
Well, blessedly, we don't live in France because, I think that's kind of where you're trending with the 32-hour work week and restoring the pensions for all. Is it possible? Sure. But I think this thing is very front-loaded with a lot of instant and semi-instant gratification, as in over the life of the contract, that I think it will make that go down a little bit easier. Remember, the things that you ticked off, or at least pensions for all, for example, is something that doesn't probably affect the majority of the voters, the members who are voting, rather. So they'll have it essentially wired so that it has enough front-loaded that people will vote for it. Now, you raise a good question. These contracts mean nothing if they're not ratified. So, I mean, everybody involved, both sides, want these ratified. Because if it's not ratified from the company's perspective, the union's going to come back and say, we're going to need more.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're at the companies, we talk a lot about all these details. But really what the company looks at is a bucket of money. And it's just a question about, they're arguing about how they're going to divide up, how they're going to divide that pot up and how big that pot's ultimately going to be. So if it were to fail, could they try to move some things around? that would probably be the first instinct, because they don't want to put more in the bucket. They may have to put more in the bucket if the ratification fails. I think the leadership is saying, we think this is good enough to get ratified. And so we have a tentative agreement.
Investors didn't seem overly concerned. We also had Ford announce its third quarter earnings statement yesterday. But in after hours trading, it fell about 5%. I've seen cost estimates on this that it could cost as much as $3,000 more per vehicle in added costs. I've seen it a little bit lower. The consensus figure seems to be somewhere in the $900 range. Do we know what it is? And is that going to necessarily translate to a price increase? Is this going to be put on the backs of consumers? Or will Ford find a way to squeeze costs out elsewhere to pay for this?
Probably all of the above. I mean, obviously the court has to be sensitive to how much of a price increase they're going to pass on to consumers. The supply base is going to get its own squeeze. I don't think there's any question about that. And they're going to continue to work these numbers. And my own estimation is, any way you look at it, things are going to be more expensive because money is more expensive. People who have leased vehicles a couple years ago are going to come back and are going to be shocked at what it would cost to get the same vehicle. He raised the other point that I think is we need to also bear in mind here. The companies went into these negotiations being the most expensive per hour, having the most expensive per hour labor costs in the industry, and they're going to come out of them having even more expensive per hour labor costs. That gap is going to widen. So, and at the same time, you have a union leadership that says, all that teamwork we used to talk about, we're not doing that anymore. You're not our partners. And I think over the midterm and longer term, that's going to prove to be a very short-sighted posture, particularly at a company like Ford, where there's a lot of multi-generational workforce families. We're very proud to work for what they call Fords. Mm-hmm. And to have the president of the union belittling Bill Ford, and accusing him of threatening to close the Rouge, I think doesn't sell very well. And I think there's a lot of people, in fact, I know there's a lot of people that have written to the company after that and have expressed their displeasure with some of it.
Daniel, we had an automotive expert with the college tour, I don't remember if it was yesterday or the day before, but said the foreign automakers don't have to get UAW in there for their workers because they're going to just raise their wages because they're watching what's going on and they don't want to lose their workers. Do you think that will happen and therefore this gap won't be as wide as what you're saying?
Well, I think that is a phenomenon that does tend to happen, as I understand it. The foreign automakers operating in the United States are notoriously closed about their employment practices. They don't share a lot of information, particularly with the news media. I think you would expect that they would raise their wages and potentially sweeten some of their benefits as a bulwark against it. It's interesting to note that I haven't seen in a long time union leadership as open about its intent to make workers for Toyota, Honda, Volkswagen, BMW, Mercedes, Honda, Kia members. When they have absolutely abysmally failed at organizing those folks for years.
Yeah.
And I think the belief is that this contract is going to be the clarion call. This is what you get if you come to work for us. But these companies are very embedded in where they are in their states. The UAW doesn't have the best track record in recent years, particularly the leadership, of being safeguarding the members' interests. I mean, you had two former presidents who were sent to federal prison, and close to, I think it was 15 or 16 leaders of various stripes who were convicted in a corruption probe, which you can bet will be used against the union in any organizing drive.
But Sean Fain's got a pretty powerful pitch now, because, for instance, at Tesla, for the all-in wage is $45, well, they're making 60% less than what the Ford workers will be making in terms of an all-in wage. And that could be a pretty compelling argument for Sean Fain. It also is, from a competitive standpoint, a pretty alarming gap.
Mm-hmm.
Yep, you're right on both counts.
Daniel, we thank you so much, my friend. We will await the Ford Council's decision this weekend and then the rollout for the rank and file and as they decide. Have a great weekend.
You too.
When we come back, the legal implications going on with his sign stealing at University of Michigan, but also Mel Tucker answers his accusers after an independent commission says he committed sexual harassment. Where does that leave us legally at both schools? We'll check in with Todd Flood next on News Talk 760. Well, as we concluded our campus tour, there was some turmoil on at a number of the schools. Certainly at Michigan State University, they're going to have a Board of Trustees meeting today where they are in open conflict, where trustees are feuding with one another. There have been calls for the resignation of the chairperson. And then there is the sports department, both at Michigan State and at U of M, both of them facing separate controversies involving their coaches or their coaching staffs. And there's some legal problems with all of this and some interesting developments. We turn to Todd Flood, attorney and managing partner at Flood Law, for some insights into all of this. Todd, good morning.
Good morning, Guy. How are you?
Very good. So there's this report that an outside investigating firm was the one that approached the NCAA about these allegations of sign stealing. What the heck was this? Who paid for an outside firm to come in and look at U of M? What do you think is behind that?
Well, you know, football in college is big business, right? So obviously that's where all the money comes from most universities is the football program. So you have Deflategate with the footballs. You're going to have investigations with sign stealing and you know, the old Bill Belichick move. Doesn't surprise me at all that this took place. As a matter of fact, many firms that I've partnered up with have done investigations into similar situations. So here in this particular case, I just think it's such big business that another team or the NCAA hired out a third party to see and do an investigation of whether or not U of M was actually violating the rules when it boils down to stealing signs, and the signs basically of telling what plays are going to be called the next or what they're actually going to have on the field ahead of time. That being said, Guy, that seems so crazy to me. And another way is it's been going on since the beginning of time. You can go to YouTube and see what signs there are, right? So it seems to me to be, come on, that's been going on forever. Scouting's been going on forever. So it seems to be something to me that hopefully can be extinguished quickly.
Well, Todd, there's obviously no legality in terms of getting in big trouble because the NCAA is going to decide what happens with Michigan. I think it's more than that, though, in terms of why do it then? Why do this whole big labyrinth and network if it just goes on? It seems like Michigan was doing a little bit more than others. But we can move on to Michigan State. The Title IX hearing concluded. We have a statement from the lawyer who presided over that hearing, and she said, yes, he violated the rules of sexual harassment on campus. Now what's next?
Well, now obviously it's the penalty phase, and he's gone anyway. So is there any redress? There's no redress for in this particular situation because Tucker's off the campus. The protections of Title IX in this situation are already put in place with regards to no contacts, making sure that there is no retaliation, things of that sort. The Title IX redress in most cases is to make sure that there's equal footing and protections put in place for everybody. And here, this was more about, I think, in some regards, they wanted to go forth with the substance of it. And if you remember, this is prosecution, judge, and jury are that of the university.
Right.
And in this case, the opinion written, as I understand it, in this 73-page opinion, is that the judge that's hired by the university found that Tucker's statements were inconsistent, and that there were too many inconsistencies, and he didn't have corroboration for his claims. Now, there's an appellate process. I'm sure that's going to take place, and it's not done yet. But it's more for here, the firing of Tucker, I'm sure. And then up on top of all of that, I believe the trustees for Michigan State, as I see it, there seems to be the same-o with regards to how they have ran the university in the past. Mm-hmm. And that is one where they have violations of the Open Meetings Act, and they are working in factions as opposed to with transparency. And hopefully, because I support both universities, but hopefully they can get on the right course and right track with that board of trustees and maybe the governor stepping in as well.
Todd, Tucker is suing for wrongful termination. He's going to make the allegation in court that this was a consensual affair with this woman, Brenda Tracy. How much does this conclusion by the Title IX judge help Michigan State's case? Or can Tucker's attorney say, hey, that decision was bought and paid for by the university?
Yeah, I think actually it's a double-edged sword because first and foremost, the standard of proof for this Title IX case is preponderance, but they use a very flimsy standard as opposed to that in a real courtroom. And there's a lot of material that I think is going to come out with regards to this case and how things developed. Whether or not they can get all the evidence in is going to be interesting because we now, as we talked about in the past, Guy, the text messages seem to be
missing,
received illegally. But there's a lot of fodder there. And I think Tucker still is going to have a case. They're still going to be able to say, hey, listen, the wrongful termination you besmirched the university.
Understood. And can say that it was still ethically and morally outside the bounds of your contract. $85 million, though, at stake there. Todd, thank you so much for your insights. Interesting developments.
Thank you both. Have a great day.
You too.
Well, there's a lot of hand-wringing about polarization in politics. I have found something that Republicans and Democrats
can
agree
get behind
on wholeheartedly.
Give it to us.
Congress is doing a crappy job. And I mean, they are in lockstep on this, which is very rare. Usually,
they suck.
Thank you, Lomas. You are right.
That's out of context, but we'll take it.
Yeah, and he's just not talking about the Bears. Usually, Democrats tend to have a higher view of our political institutions than Republicans. Republicans are much more openly skeptical. But in the past few months, and this survey by Gallup was taken the day after Kevin McCarthy was ousted.
Well.
So, you've got that context around it. But only 8% of Republicans approve of the way Congress is doing its job. Only 10% of Democrats. Mm. Usually there can be as much as a 50-point gap between the parties based on who's in control of the House and the Senate.
Right.
But they are so thoroughly disgusted that independents give Congress a 19-point rating. Democrats, half that much.
I mean, are you surprised?
Not at all. Over the
frustration.
You know what show we've been watching?
Over what we're watching. It was embarrassing. The headlines across the world. I think it makes sense. If you're a Democrat or a Republican, you're just mortified by
just
what's going on.
Disgusted by it all. Meantime, the president doesn't do very well amongst his own party members. His approval rating among Democrats compared to the last poll, which was just 1 month ago, He's dropped 11 percentage points in his own party. His approval is down to 75% among Democrats. That is the worst reading of his presidency from his own party. When you factor in Republicans, when you factor in independents, it falls to 37%. That matches his all-time low. And amongst independents, and this is a giant red flag for the coming election, it's just 35%.
Well, that's why Representative Dean Phillips is coming out and saying, hey, I'm jumping in.
Are you running for president?
I am. I have to. I think President Biden has done a spectacular job for our country. But it's not about the past. This is an election about the future. I will not sit still. I will not be quiet in the face of numbers that are so clearly saying that we're going to be facing an emergency next November.
And the emergency is you've got a record low approval rating of
right.
just 75% amongst stalwarts in your own party, and independents are turning against you by a 2-to-1 margin.
And he stepped down from leadership saying, I don't agree with the future, so I'm going to try and run in. And he's saying, everybody who's on the bench, meet the moment. Come into the race.
And how odd is that?
Very
he's saying,
odd when an
come
incumbent.
On in. The water's fine. Let's yeah. make this a choice. He's trying to rescue Democrats from their own walk off a cliff. And you see former President Trump's approval numbers amongst his stalwarts and his party members, and even now growing amongst independents in spite of all his legal troubles. There are so many flashing red lights there for President Biden. Speaking of red, our Red Wings, they've been a little blue the last two outings.
Yeah, just after they lose to the Kraken, they lost to the Jets last night. It's their first game without a point since the season opener, ending a six-game streak. They lost to the Jets 4-1. And it wasn't Alex DeBrincat scoring that one goal. It was Lucas Raymond, assisted by Dylan Larkin, which means Larkin has extended his season opening point streak to 8 games. He has 4 goals, 11 assists. I don't think this is time to panic, everyone. There were going to be lulls, but they do play a pretty good team, the Boston Bruins, next. So they had that historic season last year. So the Red Wings have to get back on track and take care of these penalties they're taking.
And like the Lions game against the Ravens, the Bruins game is the one that everybody's pointing to. So this is going to be the real test here to see just how tough this team is.
Yeah, we're going to see. This is an early test. Another playoff team. The Red Wings have stepped up to, you know, play pretty good against playoff teams early on here. So we'll wait and see.
Democrats are cheering the passage of a clean energy, clean power requirement in the Michigan Senate yesterday. The renewable mandate is right now 15% for utilities. 15% of their power generation has to come from renewable resources. That will jump to 50% in 2030. Now, when we've talked to utility officials, they said they believe they can make that. It gets the incremental increases get harder and harder after that. 60% in 2035, and they must be 100% renewable by 2040. Now, they can continue producing power using natural gas, but they would have to offset it with carbon capture. In other words, you've got to grab that carbon dioxide before it comes out of the stack. That is untested, untried, and incredibly expensive technology right now. So there would have to be a significant breakthrough for the utilities to continue doing that, and that is still the cheapest source of energy out there is natural gas. And we have sources of it here in the state of Michigan. We also have the ability to store it in the ground, which can lower the prices to consumers. So the question becomes, Republicans have said, look, this is going to mean more blackouts. It's going to mean skyrocketing prices. We'll see who.
We'll see. The utilities have not agreed that prices are going to jump as much as politicians have said.
No, and I think some of that is because they really can't say for political purposes. They're regulated. They don't want to poke the bear.
Have other people say it.
But they have other people say it through lobbying groups. The Michigan Chamber has said they think that this is going to make Michigan less competitive. And Democrats are saying, look, climate change is real. We are going to have to deal with it, and this is the most significant step forward that we can make. But it is, again, it's all about the pace and whether or not. Now, they were going to have it be 2035, so they've stretched it out to 2040, which is an acknowledgement on their part that they couldn't pull it off, or that the cost in terms of reliability, in terms of what ratepayers are going to pay, was going to be too high.
And yeah, I mean, so 2040 seems far away, but when you talk about the scale of this, it's so big. They got to get moving.
It is a big concern, and we'll see where that's. And again, they did build in an exit here, so if a utility can show that it's going to harm reliability, that it's going to be an undue financial burden on ratepayers, that they can get an extension for 2 years, and we'll see how many avail themselves of that. Meantime, there's just been some amazing talent, and a Michigan singer on The Voice absolutely blew away the judges. And this is in case you missed it Tuesday night. She has just an insane vocal range, and her name is Chechi Sarai. This is her rendition of a Lady Gaga song. Oh my Lord. Did you?
You were so pumped about this as we were preparing for the show. She sounds amazing, and the judges agreed.
Yeah. I mean, when you've got that, and she does it so effortlessly. You know, the song that she did in the blind auditions was Minnie Riperton's Loving You, and we know there's some amazing runs there. But
I was looking for where she's from. Do you know?
What
part of Michigan?
I think she's from the west side of the state. Okay. And I've been looking, too. That was the one thing in the M Live write-up that I couldn't find it. But there's another woman by the name of Lindsay Garcia from Lowell in West Michigan. She is competing as well. She's on Niall Horan's team. But, man, oh, man, John Legend. She's on Gwen Stefani's team.
Okay.
But I got
brand new
you,
judges.
Yeah. Meantime, overnight, Taylor Swift dropped another album.
Taylor's Virgin.
Yep. Yeah, of 1989, which was really her first big step away from country. And it's an amazing album. They said, by far, this is the best one out of the vault yet.
Well, the vault is deep. She continues to bring just hit after hit and reinventing things. And she's a genius and also now a billionaire.
According to Bloomberg, she is now officially a billionaire, joining the likes of Paul McCartney, Madonna, Jay-Z. And I would bet that they're probably behind the curve on those estimates, given the Eras tour or the Eras
movie.
I mean, she is a one woman economic wrecking ball.
Killing it.
Yeah, just amazing. When we come back at 8:19, we'll be checking in on the week one of high school football playoffs. Evan Stockton next on JR Morning. We got to wait till Monday night to scratch our Lions' itch. How they doing, by the way, in terms of the injuries? David Montgomery's out for the
still
Monday
out
night.
With those ribs, but Jerry Jacobs is returning, and you saw the problems in the secondary in the last game. Having him back will be big, and Big V on that line also practice.
Yeah, there also seems to be more than a little rumbling over whether or not Jameson Williams and Jared Goff can make a better connection.
And if the Lions make a move by the trade deadline, which is next week.
Yeah, just a few. Is it Tuesday?
Halloween.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So we'll see what comes there. Meantime, a lot of action under the Friday night lights as we begin the first round of high school football playoffs. And the first round, your Southeast Michigan Ford dealer Game Time Live will be handling that, presented by State Champs Sports Network. We're joined by our good friend Evan Stockton, play-by-play for the State Champs Sports Network. Good morning, Evan.
Good morning, guys. You had to bring up the Lions again, didn't you? I just thought I had gotten over that game against Baltimore. That was not good.
Oh, it's a new day. It's a Friday. We've cleansed.
Dr. Steve was here. You have to confront the things that are important to you.
You know, I think Lamar Jackson just threw for another touchdown, guys. It was not
While we had our backs turned, he added insult to injury. No, I think the Raiders are going to be a little bit easier than that, but we're not going to count our chickens before they hatch here. In terms of what you've got coming up tonight, this is a showdown between Portage and Caledonia. What do you like about this matchup?
Well, what's fun about it is, you know, in the first round of the playoffs, anyone who follows high school football knows, sometimes you're looking for a game that you think is going to be a close game. This game is going to be a close game. I'll put my stamp on this one. Portage Northern maybe has the best team they've ever had. Traditionally, they've never actually made it past the district final, but this team is loaded. They've got a left tackle who he's a sophomore. He's already gotten offers from Oklahoma, Nebraska, Michigan State. He's like 6'5", 280. kid's huge at 16 years old. It's crazy. I don't want to know that grocery bill. They have another guy named Jaden Walker who's going to Michigan State. They've got a lot of talent and statistically the best offense in school history. And the team they're playing, Caledonia, they're actually back in Division II. Last year they were in Division I. They made the state championship game, played Belleville, and actually gave Belleville a game, which almost nobody has been able to give Belleville a game the last couple of years. So it should be a very good game. The game's being held at Caledonia, which their coaching staff and their players have told us in the lead-up that they're going to have a great environment and lots of people there. So we're definitely looking forward to the environment, and hopefully it should be a very good game. This is maybe the biggest game in the history of Portage Northern football, so it should be good.
Well, that's a big statement. Evan, what about the terrible weather that's predicted? Will the game happen? Will they play through it?
So they will play through it as long as if there's lightning, right, they can't play. So if there's not lightning, which, you know, we've been blessed this week, the weather's been amazing. I actually got to golf again this week. I thought my clubs were retired for the year. If it's a little warmer, you know, you can't play through a thunderstorm. But if it's raining, they'll just play through it. And Caledonia's field's turf. So if it's rain, I think we're good. But if it's thunderstorming, I don't know. It could be a long night. I guess I'll just bring an umbrella and find out.
Well, that changes the game plan. More running, less passing.
Yeah, So Caledonia's best player is a running back named Brock Townsend. He's been there for a few years now. He was on the team last year that made the state championship game. Could change it for Portage Northern. They like to throw it a little bit more as well. But, like, you talk to all these coaches, and they just want to get to the playoffs, and they want to build a team that can win in the playoffs because the goal is to be playing third week in November, fourth week in November. If you play fourth week, you're in Ford Field in the state championship, so you don't have to worry about weather. But the third week, the weather's probably going to stink. It's probably going to snow. So I think all these coaches at this point, yes, if you have to amend the game plan, sure. But you're here, cool, let's just go figure it out.
You know, looking at the matchups for this first round, it's kind of surprising how many teams with losing records have made it into the first round of the playoffs.
Well, they changed the requirements.
Yeah.
Yeah, so a couple of years ago, that was inspired by teams that, you know, played in a tougher league or, you know, traditionally, schools and leagues like the Catholic League had trouble scheduling the first couple of weeks of the regular season. So the only teams they could play were the really good teams. And if they would lose a couple of weeks early, then they'd go 4-5 and miss the playoffs, and that became a whole thing. So don't ask me to explain the numbers in terms of how you get in at 4-5 and 3-6 or whatever. I was always terrible at math. I frankly think it's really cool. Last week, our game was Traverse City Central and Traverse City West, and we kind of built the whole broadcast as Traverse City Central had to win and they were in. And then I was looking at the pairings on Sunday night. Traverse City Central lost last week, and they still got in. So, you know, good for them. And all those folks who watch back the broadcast or maybe listen live can't be angry at me anymore when I said at the end of the broadcast, maybe they missed the playoffs. So, you know, everybody wins.
Evan, I was looking at the matchups for Division One. The defending champs Belleville play Ann Arbor Huron. Saleem, with that great quarterback C.J. Carr, plays Pioneer. And you like to talk about C.C. They have a tough matchup with Novi.
We do. Yes, I just said we. Oh, my God.
You're one of them.
I know. I'm third generation. Sue me. Yes, C.C. plays Novi in Week 1. And then they play Northville in Week 2, who they played in the playoffs last year. And Northville has had a very good season. Their only loss is to Belleville. You just mentioned Belleville. If they win, and if Celine wins for the second straight year, Bryce Underwood, best junior in America, plays C.J. Carr, mm-hmm. in Notre Dame.
That's a great matchup.
So, yes. So a lot of people would be focused on that. I'm sure there's a few high school football fans in Michigan. I'm sure there's a few, you know, Notre Dame fans who are keeping their fingers crossed, like, okay,
don't get hurt.
We hope, A, don't get hurt, and B, I kind of want both teams to win so we can see them play. They have both played very well every year. But, like, that's the beauty of any playoffs, and specifically in high school. I can't tell you how many times covering these events the last few years, I call one game on Friday and I'm driving home or catching up on Saturday morning going, oh, my God, this team lost. Oh, my God, this team won. So, you know, that's the beauty of the NCAA tournament. St. Peter's can make the Elite Eight, and that's the beauty of high school football. You can go 4-5 and technically still make the state championship.
Well, there are some great rivalries that just by the quirk of the calendar and the point system are going to be in the first round. We've got Birmingham Groves up against Seaholm. We've got Warren Cousineau against De La Salle. So it's going to be an exciting first round, and we will be listening beginning at 7 o'clock tonight for kickoff here on AM 760. Evan Stockton, play-by-play with the State Champ Sports Network. And it is going to be a good matchup with Portage Northern and Caledonia. Have fun, Evan.
All right. Thanks, guys. Appreciate you.
And we appreciate you. Good times. Are you taking the little one out for Halloween? Has Olivia got her costume ready?
Yes, she's going to be a pumpkin. And my parents from Pittsburgh will be here this weekend. I'm going to do a little trunk or treat with her so they could see her all dressed up. And that's Saturday. So the weather's going to be what? Freezing?
But it's going to be beautiful today. I think we got a high of 78. And then it just goes down from there, beginning with a cold front moving through tonight that's bringing in those storms for football.
It always happens for Halloween.
And I know. And Mike was lamenting on First Thing, talking about being so excited to wear your costume and then either having to put a coat over it or wear a coat under it, and then you look like the Michelin Man. that I think is going to be our reality.
There, Seinfeld coming in, there's a joke. He says, I'm Superman. Look at the pant legs, because that's all you can see.
Here's something crazy. Airbnb has artificial intelligence systems that try to trap people who are trying to just rent a house for a Halloween party. They managed to thwart 2,400 Halloween parties last Halloween using AI.
Whoa.
Yeah,
they're very against parties in the house.
Don't try it.
Read the fine print.
It is going to be a busy sports weekend. We talked a little bit about high school football. The Red Wings back in action against the Bruins. We got the Lions holding off till Monday night, but plenty of things to keep us entertained over the weekend, because we've also got the Spartans taking on number 9 Tennessee on Sunday. It is an exhibition, but still a big test, and it's got a charitable component too. This is all to help the Maui Strong Fund. We welcome in WJR sports analyst Steve Courtney and a gentleman we got to see in the flesh while we were on the WJR campus tour, Tom Izzo, Michigan State men's head basketball coach. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning there, Guy. Hello again, everyone. Coach, you got one exhibition under the belt, that going down at the Breslin Center Wednesday night, and one thing was on display for sure. That is the depth of your ball club. We talked about that when you joined me for the tailgate show last Saturday on the banks of the Red Cedar. Bottom line here, 85-43 win. Your thoughts on that exhibition victory, sir?
Well, I first of all, good morning, guys. Well, great to be back for another year. I guess that means we're all still employed, and that's encouraging.
That's a victory.
They just delivered Bloody Marys here from the Detroit Lions, so we're not quite sure. The morning's young.
Yeah, how about those Lions? So proud of them, too. I know it was a tough week last week, but they're going to bounce back on Monday night, so that's pretty exciting for our state. But, I looked at the exhibition game, and as you know, you never know what you're going to get these days. I think these first 6, 8, 10 games, I think everybody's going to be confused who's playing for who, who's where, who's why. Some of the books that come out and talk about the rankings, they come out before guys are done transferring. So it's a little bit of a time when maybe confusing for fans and media, although everything's confusing for the media now that I think of it, but it's also confusing.
Thank you for that, Tom.
For coaches. Yeah, anytime. It's also confusing for coaches, So we're trying to take in perspective. We saw some things we really liked. We saw some things we really didn't like. We'll try to fix those today and tomorrow in practice. But Tennessee is a very, very good team. Rick's a good friend of mine who's done an unbelievable job. I think we both felt we got beat in the Sweet 16, and we would have met each other in the Elite Eight last year. We played each other in a scrimmage in Tennessee. They beat us, in a pretty good game there last year that was in closed doors. And this one would have been too, except for the Maui Strong Fund. Rick is going for, I think, his fourth time. Next year I go for my fifth time. So it's something near and dear to our hearts and an incredible opportunity for our university, their university. The NCAA made a good decision, and we get to help some people, and that's what life's all about.
I'm sorry, did you say the NCAA made a nice decision?
Yeah, it's 2023.
Look at you. Let me ask you this, Tom. In that exhibition win over Hillsdale, you had four players score in double figures, 12 score at least a point. I know one thing that made you and your staff extremely happy. You had 27 assists on 33 made field goals. You're sharing the rock. My question is, with the depth that you have on this team and certainly the talent, any concerns by you that there's just not going to be enough basketballs to go around on any given night?
Now you sound like a media guy. You know, last year you were the same guy saying you didn't have enough, you know, bench. You didn't, you know. Now there's not. I mean, listen, there's always problems. Hell, today there's problems every day you come to work because it's just a different time. It's a different world, and we're all going through this entitlement stage where everybody thinks they're owed something. And playing time's earned just like everything else. And I know you wouldn't believe this, but players kind of decide their own playing time. You know, if they practice hard, they get playing time. If they play well, they get playing time. If they don't, they don't. It's not as complicated as you think. It's just thrown in there because everybody's got an opinion. And so I don't feel that way. I feel blessed to have some depth. I feel blessed that my veterans, which I have some, have really embraced the four rookies, freshmen. And, you know, I just feel like, wow, we've got something here. And because of that, but we got a long way to go, guys. You know, as you say, putting those two together, the freshmen have no experience. The upperclassmen have a lot of experience, especially the, you know, the AJs and Malik's and Tyson's and Jaden's, because they've been through the wars. They've had some tough losses in the NCAA tournament. They actually failed some, which is illegal in our day and age, but it's not illegal in reality. So I think failing makes you better. They've had some failures or let's say not successes, and I think that's going to make them hungrier and better. And if we can put it all together, we get a chance to have a very, very good basketball team.
Coach, I'm told that the ovation for when the freshmen came in was just crazy when it was just an exhibition game, but that shows how excited people are for this season and this squad. But you're talking about failing a little bit. You love to put tough matchups early on in the season, and that's why Tennessee, we see them so early here, or you see them.
Well, Jamie, that's true, and, you know, we've kind of done that my whole career, you know, with Duke and Baylor and Arizona and Butler and other teams coming up in the non-conference. But a couple of years ago, I started playing Gonzaga. I played them for 2 years. Now this will be the second year of Tennessee, and next year we'll try to schedule another two-game series with another team on these exhibition games. But I do think it brings a lot. What you kind of learn about your warts and what you don't do well. And there's nothing like playing good people, and especially when it really sort of doesn't count. And so this has been something that's been exciting for me. And having a team ninth in one poll, but in some polls we're 4 and 5. We're both top 10 teams, and not often is that. Do we get to have a game like that at home, and more importantly, one – because of the Maui Strong situation, this is going to benefit a lot of people.
It's going to be 3:30 come Sunday at the beautiful Breslin Center. I will say this in closing, Coach. All over social media, the freshman Cohen Carr, by the way, 12 points, 3 boards, 2 blocks, getting some air. And, you know, makes me think about my performances in my own backyard. There's no better feeling than soaring above the rim. And you know you're there, so I've experienced that.
That's the 7.5 foot rim,
yeah, right?
Right.
The Fisher Price rim.
I can honestly tell Jamie and Guy that I brought you in as a consultant and taught him how to do that this summer. And
thank you for mentioning
so for that. I'm forever indebted, Steve, and hopefully that'll bring great benefits throughout these talks throughout the year.
Certainly right. Looking forward to it, Coach. You know that.
Well, guys, I really appreciate it. It should be a you know, good weekend here. Hopefully our football team will get back on track. And
yes, sir.
Hey, we got to be at the point where we go Lions right now, too, because anytime T
teams in our state are doing well. It benefits all of us, and I really appreciate the effort and what they've done, and I applaud all those guys down there because I think we're getting to have a pretty solid base. We just got to continue, and we're going to have some fun. I got to get down to a Lions game, that's for sure.
Well, if you do, order up one of the Bloody Marys. They are impressive. You get a slider on top.
A shot of beer.
A shot of beer, a meat stick as
Steve,
a straw and stirrer. Yeah, it's impressive. They just dropped some by. Apparently, they're trying to accelerate our departure from our demise here on the morning show.
Yeah.
Unlike
that would be one thing I won't be doing is having any drinks in public because that's not what I need right now. But I will I'll eat one of those sandwiches or whatever else they had with it. So you guys enjoy it. Have a great day. And thanks a lot for all the support WJR gives. And I'm looking forward to another season with you.
All right. Well,
our
good
pleasure.
Luck against Tennessee. Thanks, and thanks for helping out with the Maui Strong Fund. That's a nice thing to do for our friends in Hawaii. Steve Courtney, Little Tykes All-Star, Fisher Price All-Star. Hang on, we're going to talk Lions on the other side of this break. You're listening to News Talk 760 WJR. Well, thank goodness the Spartans are playing, because I don't know what we're going to do with ourselves without the Lions playing on Sunday. We'll have to wait till Monday evening, but a great matchup with the Las Vegas Raiders here at Ford Field. And heaven knows, an opportunity to cleanse our palate and hit reset after that awful game against the Ravens. WJR sports analyst Steve Courtney joining us. And we've got a couple of key injuries, but the coach is saying, look, this wasn't the true Lions out there.
Well, much like Tom Izzo likes a test early in the season, look at it that way. A way to bounce back, regroup.
And to know what you need to work on.
Yeah.
Steve? Look at my sportsbook partner being the voice of reason. This conversation brought to you by the hardworking men and women at Bill Brown Ford. Forward down the field. Yes, the W's are stacking up, and the winged wheelers are doing very nicely. My good friend Matt Garko, of course, and his team are stacking wins each and every day. Drive with the champions at Bill Brown Ford. Shop their TrueView inventory at BillBrownFord.com today. Monday night, Ford Field's going to be absolutely electric. First things first, before we talk about the Honolulu Blue and Silver and the Raiders, our esteemed colleague, Lomas Brown, one of the great human beings in the history of human beings, will be put into the pride of the Lions, and that is going to be a very special moment.
Cosign. Love him.
We are standing and applauding. Truly one of the finest guys around. I was talking with a good friend of mine yesterday who had a chance to meet Lomas, and he goes, he really is as nice as you guys say he is. Yeah, he's genuine.
Yeah, he is, with no doubt, as I've said before, the mayor of Lionville. I mean, when you see Lowe walking around the perimeter, he can't walk 5 feet without somebody stopping him. And by golly, Lowe always stops and talks and pictures and everything else. So more evidence, my friends, that good things happen to great people. Meanwhile, you've got the Lions and Raiders. Both teams looking to find themselves. Of course, the Lions' four-game winning streak ended in Baltimore. Meanwhile, Las Vegas had 1-2 straight before they were dismantled by the lowly Bears by some 18 points. Now, the Raiders in that tilt, they had 67-year-old Brian Hoyer, the former Spartan at quarterback. It's looking more and more like Jimmy Garoppolo will make his triumphant return from that back injury. But here's the thing. The Raiders offensively, they have not cracked 20 points in 7 of their last 8 games. Offensively, the Raiders are challenged. Oh, you better believe it. They rank 30th in scoring, averaging just 16 points. Raiders are 27th in total offense and dead last in rushing, averaging 68.6 yards per game on the ground, despite having the all-pro Josh Jacobs. So there's a matchup right there where the Lions can take advantage. They've got to step up defensively. Way too soft in the loss against the Ravens. Right, Jim?
Absolutely. I got to tell you, We got delivered these Bloody Marys with a burger on top, and I'm taste testing it.
You caught her with a slider in her hand.
Steve, we'll just start all talk early because these two are eating and drinking. They're no longer involved in the
show.
How
about that Jimmy Garofalo?
Kev, hello. Tom, what it's in the hello. Hell is happening there?
You don't want to know, Steve. Just stay put.
Well, this is why you got to come in on Friday, Steve, because the Lions dropped off their 90th season Ultimate Bloody Mary in celebration of the 90th season for the Detroit Lions. And let me just tell you, it's not a drink, it's a dinner. I mean, it comes with a slider on top, cheese curds, a meat stick straw, pickles,
and a shot of beer on the side.
And a shot of beer on the side, which, of course, I'll be calling Jamie an Uber.
I was just taste testing the burger when you asked me the question, but yeah. I'm happy Jerry Jacobs is back in the secondary.
Yeah, and I was going to mention Izzo, by the way. You know, when you get a Bloody Mary up in Iron Mountain, it comes with a pasty. Hello, we'll get everybody. anyway, yeah, this is going to be a nice tilt, and based on the performance against the Ravens, you know, Dan Campbell, who again, after the Lions were dismantled, said, look, we just have to get back to basics and be the team that we are. That being said, you can look for the Lions offensively to take advantage here, hopefully. The Lions have gained 20-plus yards 36 times. They've scored on 9 of those plays, ranking second in the NFL in both categories. Jared Goff, we look forward to his return. Did not throw a touchdown pass for the first time this season in that loss to the Ravens. Dan Campbell is saying this for this beleaguered Lions offensive line. You got to account for Max Crosby. He has at least a half sack in 5 straight games. The former star at Eastern Michigan is playing some ball. He is a certified beast.
Steve, we've only got 2 minutes left, but very quickly, what do you think they may be shopping for ahead of the deadline? Will we see some deals?
Well, you know what? Just taking a look at the secondary performance, and they've had some injury back there with some of the dudes they brought in. I think that's a concern. And, you know, as great as Aiden Hutchinson is and will be, I think, and I'm concerned about a consistent pass rush, because look, if you have an effective pass rush, that makes the job of your secondary a little bit easier. So exactly what general manager Brad Holmes wants to put out there as far as price, we'll just have to wait and see. I think on the offensive side of the ball, sadly, Marvin Jones stepped away. Maybe you get a receiver, but that's just my take on it.
And, Steve, we're having the sports book downtown Monday night. We'll be together.
For the first time in a while.
Yes. Can't wait to see you.
I will be wearing a Hello, My Name Is sticker so you can identify me.
Okay.
It has been a while, but I'm certainly looking forward to that. At Buddy's Pizza, going to be a tremendous atmosphere. I certainly hope folks will stop by. And we'll get all fired up for that Monday night tilt.
Yeah, try not to make too much of the Bloody Mary stain on her blouse when you see her.
Listen, I highly recommend this 90th season Ultimate Bloody Mary. That's all I'm saying.
Hopefully come Monday night, Jamie still won't be hung over for
it's
crying out loud.
It's 5 o'clock somewhere, isn't it?
Yeah, always. Yeah, they serve 4,000 of these at Ford Field on an average game day, and you can see why. They're pretty tasty. And our thanks to Levy's, Chef Matt, Chef Tina, came in with this mobile Bloody Mary lab. But something to check out if you should be at Ford Field. We hope you have a great weekend. Steve, thanks so much.
Have a great weekend, you guys.
All right. And good luck to all the participants in the high school football playoffs. We will see you Monday at 6:00.